All right, darlings. So we're going to continue talking, discussing this book of Rimaches, this process. We're at the second stage. But I think before we go further, maybe some just questions about what we've discussed so far.
Ariana had a question in the last session. So maybe would Ariana like to go first? Is she with us?
Good, Ariana. Discuss, darling. Talk to me. What are the questions?
Ariana? Have we got Ariana? No, okay. So we'll do Ariana a bit later. So Viva, would you like to...
Good, Viva. Talk to me, sweetheart.
Unmute and... You need to unmute yourself, Viva.
Have I unmuted?
You have.
Good, okay.
Thank you.
Good. Talk to me, Viva. Good, darling.
Please, Ravina, this is from yesterday, actually. I realise I wasn't completely clear. When you were talking about the three realms, form, formless, and desire.
And desire, yes.
And I wasn't sure who ended up in the form and formless.
Good point. Okay.
Is it those who've achieved emptiness but not bodhicitta?
No, not at all. These realms, they're not related to bodhicitta insofar as they're not describing any of those levels. These are the realms of samsara, and the defining characteristic of being in samsara is that you haven't realized emptiness. That's the point.
So that's still in samsara.
This is the point, absolutely. And what this is pointing to, these form and formless realms, Buddha came out of this amazing tradition before him of these marvelous, brilliant Indians who developed this single pointed concentration. That's the key technique that they used. And that leads to this state of shamatha, calm abiding. But as you continue to develop that concentration or samadhi, it gets ever more subtle, ever more subtle, ever more subtle. And so for them, literally liberation is the subtlest level. And that's the formless realm. In other words, the mind is so deeply absorbed in concentration, and they've given up even all the other aggregates. There's not even any gross form, any other of the gross aggregates. The mind is the subtlest level. And as far as they were concerned, that's liberation. That's what they think. Buddha said, no, they're still in samsara. They've given up the grosser levels of suffering. They've given up the suffering of suffering. They've given up the suffering of change. They've completely subdued the senses. They've even gone beyond the need for them, but they are still in samsara because they haven't used that concentrated mind to realize emptiness, to cut the root of all delusions. So that's where he diverged from the Hindu traditions. That's where he diverged into his views about the nature of self and went further from that view. And then, do you understand the point? It's all to do with samsara.
So would anyone actually aspire to go to the form of formless realms?
No, not in the Buddhist view, not at all. Total waste of time. Completely waste of time. Totally. It's presented because it's the views from the previous time, and it's Buddha's view is in reference to that one. That they say that's as far as you could go. That's samadhi. That's liberation. No, he says. So you wouldn't aspire. And that's why even so there's three, the formless realm, then a slightly grosser level called the form realm, and then the desire realm. And within that, there are the six. There's the God realms, which is the result of just pure virtue, goodness. But that's also useless rebirth. It's a useless rebirth because you're just blissing out for like long, long time, but all your petrol tank is running out, and eventually, and you haven't realized emptiness either. And that's the equivalent of the Christian view of heaven and the Muslims' view of paradise. They probably don't posit views like the form and formless realm. That's unique to the Indians because of this concentration meditation technique that they cultivated and invented. Are you seeing my point?
Yes.
But there's no use of being, it's an utter waste of time. It's an utter waste of time being in the form realm, and it's an utter waste of time being in the God realms, because eventually you're so blissed out. It is the fruit of being good, but you're not doing anything with it. You're just blissing out and all the petrol tank runs out. It's like you're born as a millionaire and with a garden full of veggies and beautiful things, and you're so blissed out about it. You feel so lucky, aren't I lucky? And you use it all up and you don't realize it's the result of causes, and you don't create anymore. It all runs out and you've still got, and you're back down to the lower realms because you haven't cut the root of all delusions. So then within that, and then the human realm even is the fruit of virtue, but there's a difference because you would consciously rather have the human realm, which is really you know, you've got this bag of bones. The joy is nothing like the God realms, but the benefit, the sole benefit of the human realm is we got access to intelligence, and we can use that intelligence to understand the samsara and get the hell out of samsara.
Right. Thank you.
Okay, good.
Thanks, Viva. Ariane, I'm going to ask you to go next because you asked about a question in the first session, and then Olya, and then Kelly.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Hi, Romina.
Hello, sweetheart. Happy to see you.
It's so much fun to follow you around the world.
I know. It's very funny. But it looks the same. I'm in the same place every day.
Yeah, I love it. I feel like I'm home.
I know. Thank you. The only thing that changes is my orchids. I've got plenty of orchids today. I've got 3 orchids there today, all flourishing.
My question about Bodhisattva. Back in 1990, I was diagnosed with cancer and had 20% chance to make it. And here we are in 2021, so obviously I'm still here. But when you were talking about how you feel, and I remember lying on a gurney in a hall, feeling like very heavy but light at the same time. It was the end of the day. Everybody was gone. They were doing an emergency ultrasound. It was Friday in the basement of a hospital, nobody around. And something touched me on my left shoulder, put a cold washcloth on my forehead and said, "You will be okay." When the tech came out, I said, "Thank you for the cold washcloth." And she said, "I didn't do that." I said, "Well, there's nobody else here." So my question is, can a bodhisattva, when you are suffering, show up and manifest physically? Could that, an Episcopal priest told me it was an angel. And I later went back to school and became a psychiatric nurse therapist because of that, basically, because I was a number cruncher. So can bodhisattvas, do they show up? Could that have been a bodhisattva?
Of course, it's no big deal. It's no problem. Of course, that's totally possible. There's so many stories, things like that. You know, the story I tell about Harry falling off the mountain. Have you ever heard me tell that story?
Yes, where he fell back and then all of a sudden
he was falling off the mountain backwards. He said he had a psychic vision of the entire fall and saw my body crash to the ground. And then he felt the hands of this holy being, Geshe Lama Khonsog, pushing him forcefully in the reverse direction. That's one story. Lama Zopa tells another story. I mean, there's hundreds of stories like this among the Christians as well. Mm-hmm. So Lama Zopa tells the story of one guy in Hong Kong or somewhere who had cancer and sick or some kind of sickness in his bed. He was on his own and his medicine Buddha statue was on the table next to him. And he thought of his medicine. He couldn't get his medicine. It was in the next room. And he looked at the statue and there was his medicine in the lap of the medicine Buddha. Stories like this all the time. Yes.
Oh, okay. Cause see, I was a Unitarian. I didn't even know about Buddhism very much at all at that point. Cause I was like in 1990. So I had no idea other than it literally changed everything. And I felt totally fine. It was 2 years. I had a stem cell transplant. And never was I afraid. I ended up helping new patients.
Wonderful. You've got some connection.
So I guess that was my good karma. My negative karma because I got the cancer. My good karma because there was something good about.
That's the real point, isn't it, Ariane, how do you say it?
Ariane, you have, it's okay, yeah, Ariane.
That's the thing, you know, if we're the fortunate, I mean, if you look at the world, there's so much suffering, but most of us don't have the good fortune to see it in a good way and use it as a transformation. We just use it for more misery and more anger, don't we? This is a tragedy. So that's why we can see for many of us, you know, often suffering moments like this can be the catalyst for incredible change. So that shows, yes, very strong, virtuous karma from the past, from practicing a spiritual path, that you were so fortunate to be able to interpret it differently and use it for you to develop yourself. That's what's marvelous.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you for explaining that. All these years, and here I am, 70 years old, and I never really fully understood. I'm like, I'm going to ask because I wonder if that's what happened because it did.
Totally normal. That's nothing. That's a great blessing.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
So good. You can help others. That's the best way, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ariane. Thank you.
Thank you.
Olya, you've lowered your hand, but you still have a question, yeah?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Dear Robina, you ended up the previous session with telling a story about someone who actually managed to reverse the negative thought and that yes. So how is that possible to prepare to, you know, if that happens, you know, how is it possible to prepare for that? Is there any practice that can be done?
This person, now the point about this person was he wasn't a practitioner. He was a regular guy. But for what, so his own karma, he in other words, he didn't do it consciously. The negative karma ripened like hell realm suffering, and it was nightmarish. And then that seemed to complete itself. And then a virtuous karmic seed was triggered. He didn't do it consciously. The karma was there. The seeds were there. It's a bit like Ariane. She didn't do it really consciously. It just happened. The karmic seed was there for her to suffer. And then somehow she also had the karmic seeds from virtue, which ripened at the same time. That's exactly the same with this guy. He didn't do it consciously. So you can't, I mean, you can only way to prepare is to practice virtue throughout your life. Then you can ensure that, you know, the plenty of delicious virtuous seeds are there accessible. So it's just good fortune that he had that karma, just like Ariane.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you, Olya. Kelly, would you like to unmute yourself and ask your question?
Hi, Venerabina. Just a clarification, and I'm sorry if it seems I'm being picky. So in the second stage, the vision of smoke, that's when you ripen the karmic seed that's going to...
That's approximately at this time. Yes, yeah. Roughly you can say it's about this time the conditions come together.
Yeah.
That the grasping from the 12 links, this intense grasping triggered, much fear comes, and that's the catalyst for the karmic seed to be unlocked, which will be the one that will determine your next life.
So that's when us as somebody with the person that's dying can influence that in a positive
way. That's when you can be helpful. Because the grasping is going to happen no matter what. It's a bit like you're crossing the road and you're full of fear, that the fear is going to be there, but having a person help you across can subdue your fear and can help you think of other positive things. So it's like you're holding the hand of your beloved. And that's why also you need to become familiar with this process, because you should know when it starts. So it's at that period, knowing the practices your loved one loves, knowing the name of the, you know, knowing your loved one's Lama, let's say they're a Buddhist, you're able to be saying the prayers they want at that time as you're going through this process. So the grasping is rising, the attachment is there, but they can hear your voice, they can hear the Dharma, they can hear your Lama's name, they can hear the mantra, and that steadies them, and their mind can be virtuous at the same time as the grasping, and that can be the one that can trigger the virtuous seed. That's the actual technical point. That's when you're crossing the freeway.
Yeah.
Understand what I'm saying?
It mentioned there when we were talking about the things that were breaking down, that the ear sense base breaks down as well during that stage. So I guess I was just concerned about...
You still can hear something, but this is what I want to get to in a minute. Hearing, this is what's interesting. The subtle consciousness can be aware of these things, even though, so this is the one I'm going to get to, and it's a really major point about why you don't disturb the person after they've stopped breathing. When you completely have ceased all the four senses and you're not breathing and you look like you're dead for the Western world, your subtle consciousness is conscious, and that's the same as your dream mind. So there are reports from people all over the world from being conscious during their dreams, and that's what out of body experiences are. People, having out of body experiences, they're completely unconscious. They're in a coma, but they can hear everything. I mean, there was one fellow I read about, one Italian mummy who wouldn't let them pull the plug on her boy who was in a coma, and they kept him breathing for 25 years. He came out of his coma and he said he was conscious the whole time. So, you know, I remember having it at a time, one time during one retreat when I first became a nun. And, you know, during a retreat, your mind gets a bit sensitive. I'm no meditator, but something has to happen because you're meditating for 3 months, 12 hours a day. So your mind gets a bit more subtle sometimes, fortunately. And then during the certain period was in India, in Dharamsala, we'd have our retreat. It was during the rainy season. And the very traditional in India, during the rainy season, you have a nap. Because when you're doing a retreat, you get very tired, you know, so you have this nap. And I remember for a certain period during that retreat, I had these vivid, vivid dreams during my lunchtime nap. People call it, you know, what do you call it? Lucid dreaming. It's your subtle mind. But I was completely conscious of all the sounds around me. I was totally asleep. I didn't see anything, but my ear consciousness, because that's the subtlest one. Think about it. So people in comas, you can hear things. This is why it's so important not to disturb the person, but it's why also it's so important. You can help the little mouse. You can help the dog. You can help your grandma. You can help the baby when their subtle mind is there, because there's, even though we're going to go through the stages, they can be conscious. People can be vividly conscious at that level. And there's a whole set, another discussion. We'll get there later when we talk about the scenario of if your loved one wants to give their organs. We'll talk about that then. The subtle, even though it's ear consciousness, your subtle mind is capable of being conscious. I mean, okay, there's one book I remember reading at the time. I'll discuss this more when we're talking about organs. Well, I'll mention this piece here though. I'll just mention this one. Yeah, that this. Oh, yeah, forget about this book. I'll tell you about that book later. Okay, so we know people all over the world report what they call out-of-body experiences, either, and particularly, let's say, during an operation. They're unconscious. They're like completely, you know, they're on, what's the word? What do you have when you go to sleep in operation? What's it called?
Anesthetic.
Anesthetic, you know, they're totally unconscious. Their senses have ceased, but their subtle mind and the experience many people report is as if they're floating above their body, but out of their body. Well, technically, they're not out of your body. The subtle mind, if it did leave the body, you'd be dead. Your mind is in your body, but the experience you have is as if you're out of your body. And that's what so-called astral traveling is. People who feel they've gone to Africa and gone to, you know, they travel over the world, their mind doesn't leave their body. They stay in their body, but the point is your subtle mind, because it's not dependent upon the senses, and when you know, that's got the capacity to extend its capacity for cognition to other places, other, you know, and in the, so the minds of others and experiences, that's what the subtle mind is capable of. And when you've really got proper clairvoyance, which you get from getting single-pointed concentration, and the Buddha says we've had it in countless lifetimes, you've got this crystal clear clairvoyance. You can see the minds of others. You can see long distances. It's as if you are there, but your mind is in your body. That's very clear. But the experience of people who have random events of it, like during their operation, or I remember one woman I knew who was sexually abused really brutally as a child. I mean, like raped, I don't know, it doesn't matter the details, hundreds of times, if not thousands, including by her mother, her father, dogs. She's made to have sex with dogs. You can't imagine. So she would just disappear and she'd float up in the sky and completely like have an experience of out of her body. That's a really typical one. And that's, but she doesn't leave her body. She goes into her subtle mind, you know. You can't do it properly. You don't know how to do it. We don't know. It's just a mysterious experience. But when we've got clairvoyance, we can do it naturally. So that's the capacity of the subtle mind. And that's what happened, why we get to the point when you stop breathing, you do not touch the body for 3 days at least, because the subtle mind is now there and hasn't left the body yet, but there's no sign of life. And that's where the big discussion about organs, which we'll get to later, why it's quite an interesting conversation, you know. I'll tell you what Rinpoche words, what Rinpoche says. Are we clear, people? So there are more experiences. No, more. Another one, I remember a friend of mine, Judy, in Sydney, was in hospital. She was in a deep coma, and she was in the ICU. And I'd go there at night to visit her. And I just say prayers in her ear. Now, she was very close to Dzongsa Kyentse Rinpoche and His Holiness Sakya Trinzin. She was close to these lamas and their family. So I'd asked her students, their students, to ask the lamas to pray for Judy. So I'd go to the hospital at night and I'd say prayers in her ear. And occasionally I'd say, Judy, Dzongsa Kyentse Rinpoche is praying for you. Judy, His Holiness Sakya Trinzin is praying for you. She was deeply unconscious, you know, and she was in there for weeks, and she came out of a coma eventually, and she was completely fine. And she told me when I visited that the only thing she could remember was this husky voice, and she didn't know it was me. And she thought it was a blue lady coming through the window. The only thing she could remember was this husky voice saying exactly those words. Judy, Dzongsa Kyentse Rinpoche is praying for you. Judy, His Holiness Sakya Trinzin is praying for you. The only thing she could recall. This is the power of the holy beings. Christians talk like this as well. So your subtle mind is incredibly much more powerful and more receptive. So that's why it's so special and important for the mouse, the dog, the baby, the grandma, to, when they are unconscious, when they're in a coma, when they're asleep, you keep the room. One of the key things about the room of the dying person, you make it completely silent. The only sound is the sound of prayers and mantras, etc., which can benefit their mind. It's incredibly important. And once they've stopped breathing as well, you treat it like a shrine room. If you do keep, you know, most people won't do this. I mean, I talked to Yeshi Kadro in Australia, the nun who ran for many years, ran Karuna Hospice Service in Queensland. It's been, it's an FPMT centre. It's been around since the 80s, started by one monk, and it's very well known in Queensland and generally speaking in the movement, because it's got funding from the government. It's got, you know, it's palliative care. People go in and help the dying people in homes as well as in hospices. But she said most people don't die at home now. Most people, even those who've got care from services like hers, they still die in institutions, you know. So what I'm getting at here, what was my point? I forget the point I'm about to make. No, it's so important that you choose the right condition. And I'm really in thinking of this way, thinking about this, that hospitals are really about the worst places to die, you know, not all due respect to kind nurses and doctors, because you need a totally silent environment that can only where you hear prayers and practices. So because the subtle mind can be so conscious of that, and that can be the greatest blessing. And this is the other point, even if a negative karmic seed has been triggered before you stop breathing, by doing all your prayers and practices during this period, you can help reverse the process. You can help virtuous karma be triggered. So it's crucial, Rinpoche mentions that every chapter, quiet, nothing else, keep everything else out. You really control this environment so that it's conducive for the mind of the person to be peaceful and virtuous, and for the sounds of prayers and mantras, which are so much more subtle than the visual, than all the other senses, to benefit the person's mind during those 3 days while they're in a coma, while they're unconscious, while they're asleep. This is crucial to understand, you know. Any other questions?
Thank you, Kelly. Does anyone else have any other questions for Honourable Riga? Kimberly, I can see your hand going up there. Yeah? Would you like to unmute?
Yeah, thank you. Rabina, I was in a hospital, similar story. Things were not going super well. And I did see my room fill up with smoke. And I don't know if this is my imagination or if it
could have been the going through the death process. You could have been that, but you didn't go all the way. That's not an uncommon thing. People come back to life.
Yeah, little colorful lights in the distance.
Oh, there
you go. Green, red, can't remember the rest. And at first I thought there was a fire in the hospital. And then there was no fire. And it was in an emergency, and there was someone in psychosis who was screaming in the hallway. Uh-huh. At the same time, and I was kind of frightened already, and then I just switched my thoughts to protecting the nurses and the man who was going through the psychosis, and it seemed to change it.
That's the second sign. When your mind, you've still got your wits about you and you can still hear a little bit. Yeah, that's a possibility. But, you know, obviously you didn't die. Like me with the sign of sinking into the bed, I didn't die either. So that's a very not uncommon. And that's something, that's a not an uncommon experience. It's interesting. That's a possibility. Absolutely, Kimberly.
Possibly real? Does it not imagine? I never knew if it was just my imagination.
It could have been, but I'm also saying it could have been that. Exactly. Of course it could.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly.
What else, Steph? Any other questions there? We'll carry on.
Are there any other questions? Maybe if you have one, just raising your blue hand. Okay, Elisa, would you like to ask a question?
Who's asking?
Elisa. Go ahead, yes. Elisa.
Talk to me. Yes.
Okay. My question is, how can I train my mind to become more conscious when I go to sleep? What can I do? What kind of practice? I try to remember to think, may I see my dreams as dreams, but how can I practice?
By practicing during the day. You can't do it at night if you can't do it during the day. You've got to practice concentration every day. That's it. You've got to practice concentration every day. You've got to just follow the path. First level of practice, control your body, control your speech, live in vows, do lots of purification because that helps your mind, and then do some concentration every day. And then when you go to sleep, you go through that, you do the meditation on the 8 stages. I mean, you can't do it at night if you can't do it in the daytime, you know? So you just practice all the stages of the path because they're all presented in an orderly way that enables you to get to do that. So you need to understand the teachings on concentration, meditation. You need to understand you've got to purify your mind and live in vows. You can't do it without living in vows. You can't do it without all those other supporting practices. So you just practice every day and keep getting better at it, sweetheart. There's no shortcut. Do you understand?
Yes, thank you.
Good.
Thanks, Elisa. Olya, would you like to unmute yourself again?
Thank you. Yes, thank you. Rabina, a very quick one.
if there is a possibility for us during this retreat to do one of those purification practices with you, just to remind, you know, I guess there are, I heard different, I guess, slightly different interpretations, and I remember, yeah, I just would be grateful if you could, if you could have one with you.
I understand, but different interpretations of what, sweetheart?
A purification practice. I mean, just different ways,
of negative karma. We can do that, certainly. I can lead a short purification practice. I can do that, definitely.
Thank you so much.
I'll do that, okay. All right.
Thanks, Olya. Anybody else with any questions for Venerable Rubina?
We'll keep going, and we'll have more questions later, Steph.
Okay.
Basically, I've got to the second stage, and this is at this point, as I said, you know, the karmic seed, at about this point, the karmic seed, the mind's starting to get more subtle, the grasping kicks in, and the karmic seed that will determine your next life will be triggered. And if it's a negative one, it'll be a very, this experience from now on will be a very horrifying experience. If it's a negative one. If it's positive, it'll be a very blissful experience. That's what's interesting, you know. So the third one is, as the aggregate of discrimination, which is this ability to distinguish between this and that, every millisecond is happening. Dissolves. You can no longer recognize your friends and relatives. In other words, your mind's diminishing, you know. As the wisdom of discrimination, another one, there's an aggregate of discrimination. There's one of the wisdoms, there's a similar aspect, a similar part of your mind, or similar thing. This, when this dissolves, you can no longer remember anybody's names. The people around you become blurs. As the fire element dissolves, the body's heat gradually ceases and the capacity to digest food ceases. And as the nose sense base dissolves, breathing in becomes difficult and weaker and breathing out becomes stronger and longer. And as the inner smell dissolves, the subtle capacity, the subtle energy, you can no longer smell anything. You'll have a vision of fire sparks, like the sparks that come when you burn dry grass, or like starlight, or like a sky filled with fireflies. So each of these elements is the first one is the mirage, the interplay of earth and water, isn't it? The next level is the interplay of water and fire. And now it's the interplay of fire and air. So the fourth one, how the heat leaves the body. This is interesting. You can judge the type of rebirth you will take by where the heat in your body begins to dissolve. Okay, yourself, I'm sure you won't be aware of it, but certainly others. So, you know, if you are dying with a positive attitude, with virtue manifesting, and the virtuous karmic seed has been triggered, you know, which will cause a happy rebirth, your feet will get cold first. And the heat will eventually only be at the heart. So the feet get, so that means, you know, your crown will still be warm. If you're dying with non-virtuous thoughts, such as fear or anger or attachment, which causes a suffering rebirth, the head will get cold first. And again, the heat will eventually only be at the heart. So this is, I mean, not that you can do much about it. I mean, I joke and I say, well, if your head gets cold, if your head gets cold first, that's a problem. If your feet get cold first, that's a good sign. That's the point. But what can you do about it? I'm not sure much. If you know what's going on, you can support or help with prayers and things, you know, but that's an indication. So the fourth point now is the vision of a flame. Or as the aggregate of compounding aggregates, they call it, which is all this little grab bag of leftover bits and pieces that we're made up of, dissolves. You can no longer move your body in your awareness of worldly activities and worldly success and their necessity cease. In other words, this wisdom dissolves, this all-accomplishing wisdom, they call it. Even if you could hear a name or a word, you wouldn't remember its meaning. In our daily life, we normally remember the meaning of something and then act it. But now you can't think of the meaning of anything. In other words, you lost the plot completely. You don't even know who you are. All the capacity. So this is gradually, this gradual process of this deconstruction of all these components of you. By this point, you've lost the plot, you know. And now, the wind elements and you stop. This wind element stops, all the wind energies, the grosser wind energies cease and you stop breathing. As your tongue sense base dissolves, your tongue becomes very short and thick and turns blue at the root. And this too is a sign of imminent death. If you try to talk, it'll be hard to understand. You won't be able to do it. So I always say this, Geshe Rabchen, one of my lamas, one of Geshe Lama Zopa Lama Yeshe's lamas, Geshe Rabchen. I always remember he said that this tongue that has spent its life gossiping is now useless. very sweet. I like that. So as your body sense base dissolves, you can no longer experience, you know, all the sensations with your tactile consciousness. As your inner taste dissolves, you can no longer taste anything. And your inner touch dissolves, you can no longer experience any tangible things. Your sense, you know, your tactile consciousness has ceased. So now you'll have a vision of a flame. Actually, according to Song Rinpoche, it is more like the light around the flame, a dim red-blue light. So now you, now the outer breath has stopped and the gross consciousness have ceased. So now 22 of the 25 components have ceased. 4 of the 5 aggregates, 4 of the 5 types of wisdom, the 4 elements, and 5 of the 6 sense bases, and the 5 inner sense objects, as they describe, you know. So during the 5th, 6th, and 7th stages, subtle consciousness, this next 3 stages, now your subtle consciousness, which is all your mental states. We'll go into these. I won't say that. So now your subtle consciousness, basically, so now you stop breathing. And now this is when in the modern world, they think you're dead. And this is where the topic about giving organs is very, very interesting. We'll get to that later when we discuss the different scenarios. In other words, at this point, once you stop breathing, we'll continue the process, but the crucial point is all the instructions, what to do once you stop breathing. So that's where we kick in, and now what to do if your loved one has died at home, what to do if your loved one dies in hospital, what to do if your loved one dies suddenly, what to do if your loved one dies, who wants to give their organs, what to do if your loved one dies a meditator. It's from this point then that those instructions kick in, you know, because this is what we think of as death, but it's not, you're not dead yet. So now the next level is your subtle consciousness. And this is the point, the equivalent of sleep. This is when you're now fast asleep. But of course, death is more radical, isn't it? Because your breathing stops altogether. So now the white vision. So there's a whole other system here. Now, all these subtle mental states, which are the mental states, they talk about they often refer to them as the 80 superstitions. It's just 80 different mental states. And at the first 33 of these dissolve at this point. So the book by Lati Rinpoche, they describe each of these. It's a much more technical explanation of all these different states of mind. They cease to function. And this clearly is all coming directly from the experience of the great yogis who become Buddhas at this point, you know, because they see exactly what's going on. So the winds in the right and left channels. So there's two central, the central channel and the two left and right ones either side. So all the wind energies in the right and left channels. So at this moment now, all the wind energies in all the other channels have all come into these side channels and the central channel. That's what happens every time you go to sleep. So the states of mind, which are riding on the winds, they say that. The winds, when the winds collapse and go through the channels and all come into the central channel, then the minds that ride on them have no basis, so they stop functioning. That's how they talk. So now the winds in the right and left channel move up and open the head chakras. So these constriction here opens up, and they're now loosening the knots there, and then they enter the central channel, these wind energies. This causes the white, what they call the white bodhicitta, or the white drop, or the white kundalini, often referred to as the white bodhicitta. They call it that. At the crown, it predominates at the crown, and that's the source. I mentioned before the subtle red and white drop at the heart, but also there's a predominance of this white and red energy within our body. And so the white one predominates at the crown chakra. And that's the source of the capacity of us to experience pleasure, joy, happy feelings. And the red kundalini predominates at the heart chakra. And that's the source of our capacity to feel heat in the body. So what Lama says it's very technological. It's like highly technical. It's this detailed technical description of the subtle winds and subtle mind and subtle energies and the great yogis, how they can use and manipulate these energies so that they can consciously get their mind to the very subtle state so they can get all the realizations. That's the job of the tantric yogis, you know. So that they're completely in charge of this process, the great yogis. So this causes the white bodhicitta at the crown. So the wind energies release and they go down. So this causes the white kundalini at the crown to melt and flow down the central channel to the heart, touching the central channel as it goes. Now you experience the white vision. the mind of white appearance, like very bright moonlight in autumn, or like the almost white sky caused by the light of the rising moon when everything is covered with snow. And then Rinpoche also says, whereas the previous inner visions had some movement to them, this and the following ones are perfectly still. So the red vision, next one, the next 40 of the 80 superstitions, all these mental states dissolve. The winds in the right and left channels now move down and open the sex and navel chakras, loosening the knots there and enter the central channel. This causes the red bodhicitta at the navel to shoot up the central channel to the heart chakra, touching the central channel as it goes. Now you experience the red vision, the mind of red increase. It's like the clear red sky just before the dawn breaks, or like a copper red reflection in the sky, and it's perfectly still. Then the seventh is the dark vision. So the final seven of the 80 superstitions dissolve, all the levels of subtle consciousness, the subtle mental states. The red and white bodhicitta meet at the heart chakra in the indestructible drop, which is what came from your mummy and daddy, in the central channel with its red and white halves. Now you experience the dark vision, the mind of dark appearance. It's as if you've fallen into darkness, or it's like a dark and empty sky, or being in a dark room. At the beginning of this vision, you have some awareness and recognize an appearance of darkness, but then you become unconscious. This is talking about yogis. We're not aware of it, you know. Now the extremely subtle consciousness, and this is called the eighth one, the clear light vision. Now, in other words, all the grosser levels of our conceptuality, sensory consciousness, have completely ceased. We've now gone to the subtlest level of our mind. So obviously, if we think that death is when you stop breathing, it indicates that our modern, you know, the materialist philosophical view of the person is very limited, with respect. But this is why it's marvelous, all these years with His Holiness, especially an organization called Mind and Life. 30, 40 years now, incredible discussions with all the best brains of the West. And they're seriously looking to all these things now, you know, which is so fantastic. Now the clear light vision appears. This is the subtlest level of mind, occurring only after all the grosser consciousnesses have ceased. It's like an autumn dawn when the sky is so clear, no clouds, no dust. It is not bright like at noon, not red and not dark. Nothing else appears. The yogis continue to meditate at this point and can stay as long as they like, as I mentioned in chapter 7, and we'll discuss further in chapters 10 and 24. And again, for ordinary people who have no awareness of what is happening, it could be 3 days before the mind leaves the body. So how the mind leaves the body at the time of death. So death occurs when the indestructible drop splits open and the extremely subtle mind and wind leave your heart chakra in the central channel, and depending on which rebirth you will take, exit the gross body at one point or another. So if you be reborn in a pure land of a Buddha or the formless realm, it seems, your mind leaves from the crown. If you will be born as a human, your mind leaves from the eyes, as a hell being from the anus, as an animal from the sex organ, and as a hungry ghost from the mouth. So this is why they say it's really important not to touch the body once the breathing has stopped, because even though the gross mind has ceased, still the mind is there. And that can be disturbing. It could be disturbing to the person. So I always think of this one. If you're kissing your loved one when they're dead, I mean, and you're going to get born a human, you're going to get born a spirit. I mean, you know, that's going to force the consciousness to come and leap out through the mouth. Thank you very much. Don't kiss me when I'm dead, okay? I mean, that's the point. It would activate that, which is not cool for your loved one. Leave them alone. The consciousness can also leave from the navel, the ears, or the nose. It can also leave from midway through the eyebrows. Perhaps this would be the case for someone who'd be born in the form realm. If it doesn't say more. The signs of death. When the mind leaves the body of a man, the white bodhicitta, this white, subtle white drop, once the heart chakra, once the indestructible drop opens at the heart chakra, then the white drop will continue down the central channel and would leave out through the sex organ. And that's one of the signs. You can see it there, like a subtle white kind of liquid. I mean, it might be difficult if there's pee and everything there. It might be difficult to see it. And then the red continues up and leaves through the nostrils. You can see this pinkish liquid coming out the nostrils. That's a sign that the mind has left the body. In a woman, it's the reverse process. There are other signs too, which Rinpoche talks about in chapter 25, but I'll mention it here. One of the common ways to check, and this is what Rinpoche says at the end of every one of these scenarios, what to do when your loved one dies, before you do anything with the body, you check that the mind has left. So one of the ways of checking, apparently, is if the mind is still in the body, the rest of the body will be cold, but right at the heart chakra, in the center of the breasts, if you put your hand just above there, this is in animals as well, it'll be distinctly warm. That shows the mind is still there. Because if there's warmth in the body, it's because the mind is there. So the intermediate state. The moment the indestructible drop splits open, your very subtle consciousness leaves from the heart chakra. And that second, you become now an intermediate state being, even before it leaves the gross body. The extremely subtle mind, the extremely subtle wind that is the vehicle of the extremely subtle consciousness becomes the condition for the intermediate state being's mind, and the extremely subtle consciousness becomes the condition for the intermediate state being's body. So always got this subtle, always got this physical and mental energies inextricably linked, like I said. You can see the world you just left, your relatives and your dead body, but the karma is finished and you do not recognize any of it and you have no desire to go back. You hear different things about this, you know, but this is Rinpoche, what he's saying. So then you then go through the 8 stages in reverse order, the dark vision, the red vision, the white vision, the 80 superstitions and so on. And then you take the body of an intermediate state being. This body, which is subtle and has no resistance to matter, is similar in appearance to the body of the next life. That's what a spirit is. And that's another type of rebirth. Sorry, it's another experience. But a spirit, for example, or a ghost, you know, is a type of rebirth, an intensely suffering rebirth. This is not what we're discussing here, but that's the physical body is not like gross bag of bones like this one. And you could argue that's like the element that predominates there is the air element. So the mind is conjoined with the air element. And that's why spirits can enter into people, enter into animals, walk through doors, because their mind is, because their physical energy is air energy, but it's not fun. It's horrible birth. It's a terrible rebirth, you know, but this is similar for the intermediate state. But it's a mental state. And it's just like the dreams. The dreams is exactly the same. When you go to sleep, you go through the 8 stages reverse and you wake up in a dream. The difference here is it's in your own body still. You're still that person. But an intermediate state is you're no longer your Rabina. But the type of intermediate state experience will be very much as a result of the karmic seed that has been triggered. So if it's going to be a future rebirth, Rinpoche says it. You can see, you know, he says, the longest time spent in the intermediate state is 49 days. So that's measured by human experience, you know. And that's an interesting point too, because it's such a subjective experience, how long something takes. It's a human construct, isn't it? I'll tell you a story about this. It's interesting. No, I'll discuss this first and I'll tell you the story. But if rebirth hasn't happened after the 7 days, you will experience what is called a small death, again taking your body in the intermediate state for a further 7 days until another small death occurs or a new rebirth is found. So if your mind is not clouded by delusions, the intermediate state is a wonderful experience. It's like very delicious dreams, you know. It is even possible to attain enlightenment in the intermediate state, like Lama Tsongkhapa did. Well, the greatest yogis can do that, you know. So for a mind clouded by negativity, the intermediate state is terrible. It's like a bad dream, you know. There's much fear as you experience karmically created visions, because everything's karmically created. All the things you experience in a dream are karmically created, you know. They're your karmic appearance, created by your mind. Such as feet being pressed down by the earth, stuck in big cracks, tossed by a sea wave, consumed in a whirlpool or in a great fire. You suffer because of not recognizing these as visions, just like we do in a dream. That's why experiencing dream as a dream, realizing you're dreaming, is a very powerful thing to practice, because it's your karmic appearance. But we believe all these things are real, you know. We believe all the things are real in our life as well. You'll suffer because of not recognizing these as visions, as the projections of your deluded mind. If you could recognize this, the fear would be less. You believe them to be true, so the suffering is severe. That's why we suffer in life. So even if you're destined for the lower realms, things can change. However, even if you've created much negative karma and destined for the lower realms, let's say a negative seed was triggered back before you stopped breathing, special practices that can be performed by lamas can influence you in the intermediate state and cause you to take a favorable rebirth, such as transference of consciousness or POA. That's one of the practices in the book, you know, or another practice called Jangwa, which is very powerful, and she highly recommends this, which is blessing the remains of your beloved. Almost all in the book. Of course, success very much depends on your connection with the Lama, doing the practice, or their skill, and on the weight of intent or intensity of your observations. Rebirth as a human. Okay. So as I mentioned, the experience of being born reborn is similar to the experience of waking up. Whether we wake up to a pleasant day or a violent storm is another matter. If we are reborn in the lower realms, the awakening will be a terrible one. If from the intermediate state you'll take rebirth as a human, you will see your future parents in sexual union. This is when the karma ripens and mummy and daddy hop into bed. You're in the intermediate state and your mind is more subtle, remember? So, you know, the karma's already been triggered right before you start breathing, so you're just waiting for them you're waiting for the egg and sperm to come together so you can jump in. So this is what's fascinating. If you're going to be born as a female, if you're going to be born as a male, you will be intensely attracted to the mother and you'll have aversion for the father. This arises automatically. And as a female, you'll be attracted to the father and aversion for the mother. And because of the habit, the karmic imprint of attachment to sexual union, the intermediate state being will want to embrace, has sexual intercourse with the one it's attracted to. But as it approaches the mind, your mind in the intermediate state, it doesn't see the body of the parents, only the sexual organs, which causes anger to arise. And this anger becomes the condition for the intermediate state being to die and its mind to enter the mother's body. And as Rinpoche says, it is easy to see how ordinary birth is caused by delusions and karma. It's not, I mean, with respect, like in the Christian teachings, it's like a special gift from God. Nothing like that. It's just the result of total delusions and karma, you know. So in other words, when we understand what it means that this is a desire realm we live in, over eons of time, we have created the cause due to karma to have a realm of existence in which we exist, which is made of the five sense objects, and to have a body which has the five senses. Who do you think has caused mouths and eyes and penises and vaginas? We have, over eons and eons of lifetimes of attachment. It's like karmic evolution, you know. So the whole universe is driven by attachment. I mean, it's just very sobering when we understand it, you know. So now, you know, this wonderful chapter about death is what the yogis have been waiting for. But I'll just think whether we'll say this now or later. Maybe we'll discuss this later. What time is it? 11:20. We have an hour and a bit, half an hour and a bit. Okay, so maybe the next section, you see now, Part three is what to do now that's all the background. That's all the background. So now we go into, this is the way the book is constructed. We've discussed this already, what to do in the weeks and months before. But what we need to do is go to part five, which is now what happens. What do you do once your loved one has stopped breathing? You know, this is what we've just discussed. Well, that's where the point we're at. This lesson, all these sections are what we discussed already, what to do the weeks and months before, what to do the days before, what to do the hours before, so on and so forth. All the different chapters, what to think about, what to say, what to practice, what to hear, what to meditate on, all these things, all there, thousands of practices. Chapter 15, where are we? Masses of these practices. See, most of these 87 practices, two-thirds of them are all the things you can do in the weeks and months before. And then many of them you repeat again. You can repeat at the different stages, you know, throughout the death process. The whole book is described chronologically. So, you know, like the last section of this is what to do in the hours before death. I mean, all these, you know, Okay, well, I'll discuss some of these. We didn't discuss these. There are very particular things you should do when death is coming, when death is imminent. Most of the others are like what practices, what to talk about, what to see, what to hear, what to listen to. But now, because the person's getting close to death, it's a much more fragile point, you know? So as Rinpoche always says, this is finally what to do in the hours before death. This is before the death process starts, okay? So perhaps you can't take all the advice here if your loved one is not at home or in a private room in a hospital or hospice. So simply understand the essential points and do the best you can. So the crucial one always he spends every time is be quiet. Now that death is close, it is extremely important, essential, that your loved one is not disturbed. This is the main point. As I mentioned in chapter 12, do not create any situation that upsets them. People should not cry within hearing distance of your loved one. Helping them avoid strong attachment and the other delusions during this time gives them a chance to have virtuous thoughts. If you have a peaceful, happy mind, if they have a peaceful, happy mind, they have a peaceful, happy death. This is the most crucial point because the mind is now, the grosser mind is beginning to cease and their mind's incredibly sensitive to the slightest sound, slightest noise, you know. It's exactly the same when you learn to meditate. I remember Venerable Rene, this wonderful Swiss monk who's lived in California for years, who's been a serious meditator for like 40 plus years, you know. And I interviewed him in Mandalay in 1995 about his 2.5 year retreat, single point of concentration retreat at our center in Spain, a Selin, place of clear light, named by His Holiness. In 1982, he named it that. And so Venerable Rene did a retreat there, you know, the late 80s or something. And I interviewed him, and His Holiness said it was reminded of Tibet. It was a really good place to meditate. It was beautiful, so pure, you know. So Venerable Rene was there for 2.5 years. And this is what he said, that, you know, because the process in the sutra teachings of getting shamatha is sort of like, this process has to happen. It's natural. They don't talk about it like that. That's not Vajrayana. But this is what would occur. The mind getting more subtle. The gross mind stops to see. Naturally ceases. So this is a process that would naturally occur. Naturally. So as he just, but he talked about it, he said, because you know the single-pointed meditation technique is described in terms of 9 stages of cultivation. And so he said he maybe touched upon the 5th of the 9 stages. And he said that, you know, he knew he couldn't get any further for whatever reason. There are various reasons. This is just something a bit separate, but a bit linked to this, about the mind going from the gross level to the subtle. That the 5th stage, your mind's quite subtle, he said. And he knew he couldn't get past this because he said even the slightest shift in the wind could be really distressing. Because as your mind gets more subtle, you're incredibly sensitive. The slightest shift, even in the wind, can make it very distressing. And this is this is an interesting point, as an aside, you know. One of the key characteristics of a place that makes it most conducive for good meditation, one is to be quiet, one is to have good friends and have pure food, pure water, pure environment. But the crucial one, they say, is it needs to be a place that's been blessed in the past by the presence of great holy beings, the Buddhas, meditators. That's the crucial one. And this is what's interesting, just as an aside now. The main point I'm making is, as your mind gets more subtle, you're very sensitive to the slightest shift, even in the wind, as he said. And this is where the greatest yogis are different, but he was a fairly relatively new meditator at that point. So, but the other point that's interesting, he said, I interviewed him, you see, at Kopan Monastery, which anyone who's been there knows it's a very busy place. It's on a hill in the Kathmandu Valley, but all the lamas praise Kathmandu as being a holy, holy place, you know, so blessed, so pure, so pristine, even though it's really polluted. What we see is pollution. But he said at Kopan, which is really busy, in the mornings you'll hear all this prayers to Shiva shouting out over the, you know, the speakers all around the valley. You hear the dogs barking. It's quite noisy. But he said, his mind in meditation got more subtle, more easily at Kopan than in Ursaling because it's been blessed by the presence of holy beings. So that I found was a very interesting point. But the real point I'm making here is as your mind gets more subtle, you're very susceptible. And he was a yogi. So talk about an ordinary person. When you're in a hospital and you're hearing bangings and clangings and you can feel other people's pain and hearing their cries. I mean, it will be incredibly distressing to die like that. It's the worst way to die. The worst, the worst, the worst. Be quiet, he says. Only the sounds of prayers and mantras should be heard. So now, of course, it depends on the person. But my feeling is it's not like cheating anybody. If your old uncle is not a Christian or anything and he's dying, and you have a lovely sound of someone quietly singing the mantra of compassion, how could that be horrible? If it calms his mind down, what a miracle, what a gift, you know. Not like cheating a person. It's ridiculous to think like that. So now you should recognize the stages of death. And Jay's saying this is what's important. But this, you know, this is what to do. This is chapter what to do in the hours before death. And that means you've got to know where you're at. And many people, doctors and nurses, they say she's going to die today. They can tell, you know. So you need to learn these things so you know how to be with your loved one. If you have studied the death process described in chapter 9, what we've just described, you'll be able to recognize the stages that a person's consciousness goes through as they gradually die. And thus you'll be more skillful in helping them. So various things to do to get them ready for this process of death. One of the things to do, have your loved one lie in the lion position. So, you know, this is something that you see the statue of the Buddha. This is how he passed away. He's like on his right side with his legs out, his left hand along his legs, his right hand under his ear. And even, they say, even if you're really skillful, you can put your finger up the left nostril, I think, because it stops the attachment energy. You don't need to do that if you don't have to. But that's a way that a person is prepared to die like that. You put them in that position, and you can even have your bed. And ideally, your head should be facing the west, because that's where the Amitabha's pure land is. So all these different things that they say. So if the person, you know, wants this, then that's how you do it for them. You put them in this position or you have them in this position already. So Michelle goes into this. If you've practiced sleeping in this position, it'll be easier now. Lying in this position naturally makes it easy to transfer the consciousness from the crown to a pure land. Especially remember, as we discussed in chapter 12, if your loved one is facing west, which means your head is, or you're facing west, you're facing west.
Head north. Lying on your right side, head north, facing west. I think
exactly. That's right. Thank you very much, whoever said that. Lying in this position also helps virtuous thoughts arise in the person's mind at the time of death. It makes it easy for this to happen. And it reminds them of the Buddha, that they're following in his footsteps. At the time of death, there'll be no worries. They'll be saved by this last thought of reflecting on the Buddha. If they are a practitioner, they may choose to die sitting in the meditation posture. It's up to the individual. That's not uncommon. Many of the yogis get themselves in their position of meditation and die in that way, you know. So now one of the things you could do before they die, you offer a mani pill from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. As advised in the Tibetan Ceremonies of the Dead, which is a book I mentioned that some Tibetan had written for the sake of Tibetans, not in English, it is good to give the person who is dying a mani pill. This blesses and purifies your loved one's mind, helping them generate virtuous thoughts. You crush the pill, mix it with water, and put a little into your loved one's mouth, making sure they swallow it. Chodron Rinpoche says it's important to do this before the outer breath has stopped, because after that, you should not touch the body, as discussed, you know. These pills contain many blessed substances and relics of enlightened beings, bodhisattvas and great yogis. They've been blessed with the prayers of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, the actual compassion Buddha, for the benefit of sentient beings. And many great lamas, meditators and sangha have also prayed day and night for many days, continuously blessing them. You can give the pills to children and to people who don't have the ability to understand, as well as to animals. Or you could offer a relic of the Buddha. It's the same idea, but that's usually more rare. Now, another one is you can talk. Now, again, when you know your loved one's getting close to death, you know, you can, depending on the person, your skill, what they need, you can talk about the guru, the Buddha, Amitabha's Pure Land, your loved one's good qualities, all these different practices, all which are numbered and are all in the back of the book. If your loved one has a relationship with a guru, it is good to remind them now to talk about the guru, to say their name. As I discussed in chapter 14, practice 10, merely hearing the name of the guru is one of the best methods for transferring the consciousness to a pure land. And it's good to mention the Buddhas, such as Amitabha and his pure land, the blissful realm. As I mentioned in chapter 6, this is a cause for being reborn there. And that could be for your Catholic mummy. You talk about heaven, you talk about God, depending on the person, you know. If they're a Muslim, talk about Allah, talk about whatever works for their mind. So another thing you can do is you can show holy images. You show certain mantras. You can show the pictures of Buddhas, depending on what's appropriate for the person. You can touch certain things. You bless the body with a text. This is a practice you would have done anyway, had a text either near their crown or on their heart chakra or even any part of their body. You can touch them with a stupa or a prayer wheel or a blessed cord. All these practices I mentioned before. And also you can have these written mantras on their body as well, touching their body. And then you can do different practices depending on the person. You know, maybe the person who's dying and they've got their main practice of their yidam, you can be reciting that mantra. You do what the person has agreed beforehand. You do what's best, you know. And all these other practices Rinpoche has mentioned, you can choose which ones to do. The medicine Buddha, recite your loved one's practices, do purification practices. You can, you know, just have simply let them hear this, you know, teachings by, if they're Lama Zopa student or somebody, you hear them, let them hear the teaching quietly in their ear, His Holiness, many, many different practices, all of which are mentioned in the book, all of which are here. So then also a crucial point at this point is you could organize to have monasteries or Dharma centers or friends to do practices such as medicine Buddha. You could sponsor to have these happening while they're dying. This is so powerful. Anytime it's kind of the same students of that person or the, you know, a monastery, which is the student, like in the case of me, for example, because I'm a student of Lama Zopa Lama Yeshe, having all the monks and nuns at Kopan do prayers because they're my brothers and sisters. So all this is very powerful for the person who's dying. These are the various things you can do. And then you know, as they're dying and going through the process. So now this is the part now. So even there's more. So this is now the practices to do in the hours and days after the breath has stopped. This is now the point once they've stopped breathing. And this is now the different scenarios in which your loved one dies. So the first is what to do as soon as the breath stops. This is for everybody. What to do as soon as the breath stops. Do not touch the body. Now that your loved one's breath has stopped, apart from putting the blessed substances on the crown, as we discussed before, yeah, feed them or put them on their crown. I didn't mention that one. What happened? Oh, that's a chapter. That's a practice that's coming in a second. This is one of the things you can do. They haven't mentioned yet. You should not touch the body. Touching the wrong part of the body before the mind leaves can potentially disturb the person, causing their consciousness to leave at that point and take a lower rebirth. If the consciousness leaves through the mouth, for example, they'll be born as a hungry ghost. So now this is what they say. This sounds very funny to us. As soon as they stop breathing, this really sounds hilarious. You shout. Don't whisper gently. You shout. In the loved one's ear, the name of their guru or the Buddha or God or Jesus, whoever it is that works with their mind. This is very funny, isn't it? Shout. And you need to. Even before they die, you need to shout. I remember going one time to one hospice, and then one man was a Buddhist and he was a student of the Lamas, and he was drugged out of his brain, you know, because he had cancer. He was deep in this kind of deep inertia, like drugged, really deeply drugged. And his wife, who wasn't a Buddhist, was sitting next to him. And she invited people to come sometimes, Buddhists. So I came one time. And I remember you had to sort of scream because to get past the fog of the drugs. And it sounds kind of aggressive. You don't just sit there politely whispering. He needs to know you're there. So I shouted, "Steve, do you know I'm here?" And he felt my hand. But he had to sort of get himself out of the depth of this drugs, you know. It was actually, Jerry, it was when you were there. It was when Lama Zopa was there. You were there when Lama Zopa was there when he had a stroke? Jerry? Were you there then, 2011? Jerry?
Yes, I was. Yep. I was definitely there. I was there.
I remember the same time as Lama Zopa was there, I remember this man, I don't know who it was, he was a student and his wife invited some of us to go there. Do you remember that at all? Anyway, I know I went to see him one time. That's what I'm talking about.
No, I didn't go to see Rinpoche, no.
No, it wasn't Rinpoche. No, I'm talking about, were you in a teaching then, is what I'm asking?
Right.
Were you in a teaching when Lama Zopa had the stroke, Jerry, is what I'm asking.
I was there, yes.
Oh, okay then. So all I'm talking about is I went to a hospice downtown to visit a guy who was dying. That's what I'm talking about. So just because you were there, I'm mentioning it. That's all. So I remember I had to shout because you're in this depth of this drugged state, you know. So you kind of had to kind of pull up to the top of his consciousness. And he wanted to hear the prayers. So I shouted, the king of prayers, shouted, you know. But this here is when they stop breathing, you shout. Even then, because you can still hear, maybe, you know, the name of their guru, reminding them. This is a tradition, very interesting. So as I mentioned, in practice, you know, 10, hearing the name of their guru is considered a very effective kind of transference of consciousness. Sherdon Rinpoche refers to a quotation from the Kala Chakra Tantra: to recall the name of your guru for even 1 second is the best transference of consciousness. So this is even, this is true even for someone who's created the 5 heavy negative actions. If they have devotion in their guru, merely hearing the name of their Lama can help their consciousness take a good rebirth. So now you now at this point, you touch with blessed substances. This is another practice. The tongue one is before they stop breathing. This one, you put blessed substance on your loved one's crown, at the crown chakra. So either it's a powa pill, you have to have these things in advance, an inner offering pill, a mani pill, or sand, for example, from a Kala Chakra mandala, and presumably other mandalas as well. So once your loved one has stopped breathing, and you have shouted the name of their guru or any Buddha in their ear, you can now put one of the following blessed substances on their crown at the chakra, which is toward the back of the head. Doing this can help your loved one's consciousness go to the crown chakra so that it leaves from there and goes to a pure land. Well, this does seem in spite of the fact that whatever karma was triggered before, you know, you can divert it. So you can use butter and honey to help it stick and be sure not to touch any other part of the body. So the powa pill consists of the ashes of the great yogis and bodhisattvas, also relics of Buddhas. I made some using Pabongka Dechen Ningpo's ashes. Some lamas also use those while they're doing powa. If hearing, taking a blessing from, touching, seeing, or even remembering great Haruka practitioner like Pabongka Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe can liberate us from all aspects of, from all our negative karmas, then there's no question that it's the same when we have contact with their ashes. So if you don't have powa pills, you can use inner offering pill made by high lamas. The mani pills are from His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. The sand is from a Kala Chakra mandala, also blessed by His Holiness. So when the body is taken out, you can keep the pill or sand and use it for others who die. Very practical. You can recycle the blessed pill. And then you can organize pujas. It's so important then. Different things. And this is the point at which you would organize, if the person wanted it, for lamas to do a powa. A transferring of consciousness, a particular practice. And there's one in this book of transference to Pure Land of Amitabha, a short practice written by Lama Yeshe. It's in the book. So they can either come to the body or do it from a distance. Rinpoche tells a story here. There was a lama in Tibet who heard that some people were going to be executed by the Chinese. He somehow managed to get the execution delayed and then sat in meditation and did the powa. And the people waiting to be executed simply collapsed in a heap, their consciousnesses having left their bodies, presumably for a pure land. They didn't need the bullets of the Chinese soldiers. That's a pretty powerful lama. They can actually, the really powerful ones can cause your consciousness to leave your body. They have that much power. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? When there's a very strong connection between a dying person and their guru, it is possible in some circumstances that the gurus can help the person's mind move away from negativity and towards virtue, even if the person's mind is already in the intermediate state, so that they take a good rebirth, perhaps even in a pure land. So that's the power of the Lama. See, the fact is that this is what's interesting. All these Buddhas, all these holy beings have this power. So the key factor that determines their doing it is your virtue, your merit. You know, that's what's powerful. So there's a series of now things to do in the different chapters, because there's now the scenarios. What chapter 20, what to do if your loved one dies at home, if your loved one is in a hospital, if your loved one has offered their organs, if your loved one dies suddenly, if your loved one has realizations different. They're all the same things to do, but according to these different circumstances, and the particular comments for each of these circumstances. So that the ideal scenario is to be at home or in some place where you can control the situation, meaning in a room in a nursing home, let's say, like a friend of mine, Renata, when her husband died in a nursing home, she was paying for it. She, you know, shooed out all the doctors and nurses, locked the door and stayed there for 3 days and did all the practices and was with her husband for the 3 days. You know, that's the ideal scenario. I mean, I've noticed many hospitals too, if you've got a room on your own, they're very kind. Many are very kind. When I was in Adelaide one time with a family, a Vietnamese family, and they had their room on their own and the family were there all doing the prayers. So they asked me to come and do a few mantras, you know, and the doctor would snuck in and just look because they liked it, but they left them as long as they needed. And this is something that's so important. Now, that's the next one, if you die in hospital. So the home one is ideal, where you've got control over the situation. The ideal. So because it can take up to 3 days for the mind to leave the body, in other words, for death to occur, it's ideal to leave the body undisturbed for that long. This is the ideal. So after following the instructions in chapter 19, as soon as the breath stops, do any of the following practices. You know, and of course, there's hundreds of Rinpoche gives, but you do what you need. So remember, no pets. I think I mentioned this about attachment, but in particular, they talk about cats. Cat lovers, don't get upset. It's okay. But, you know, especially cats can be, cat hair is said to be polluted. And also, if a cat sits on the dead body, it's possible that a spirit could follow it, because cats have a very kind of heavy energy and they can attract spirits. And then that can enter into the body, and you don't want that to happen. Remember, be quiet. Continue to keep the environment peaceful and quiet. Only the sounds of mantras and prayers should be heard. So now, many different kinds of practices, all of which are in the book. You can offer lights. You can bless the body with all the different texts and the stupas. You can do prayers and meditate. And people sometimes do it, rotate for the whole 24 hours, for 3 days, for 24 hours. You can do that. That's the most marvelous thing you can do. You know, you've got to have a real will to do that. Most people just see the dead body and we do a few prayers and we think, get them out of the house, you know. So we've got to really think of that person. When we think of a dead body, all we see is a dead body. We're not realizing that their mind is right there needing help. You've got to think this through, you know. Most people have so much fear even around death. They don't want to see the dead body. Just get it out of the house. That's just so cruel, so selfish. This is for their benefit. They're in their body dying to be helped by you. And if you want to be helped at the time of death, you know, my God, you think about it. That's the most precious time you can do something. So really just think about it. Don't just look at the dead body. Think of their mind in that body wanting help, needing help. It's very powerful. If you really have compassion, you'd think that way. Your dog as well, the mouse as well, the ant as well, the bird as well. I remember one time in Kathmandu, visiting a friend with Rinpoche, and he decided we'd all drive to the Swayambhu Stupa. So we took the ring road. So I don't know if you know the ring road in Kathmandu. It's like full of cows and trucks and 14 lanes of traffic, you know, all kind of chaotic, completely crazy Kathmandu traffic. And we ran over a family of ducks, the mummy duck and the five ducklings or something. But all the ducks got away except for one baby duck. This little tiny baby duck, I'll never forget it. And Lama Zopa for 20 minutes, 25 minutes in the middle of the ring road with all the trucks going around and the bulls and the cars, he was doing powa on the little baby duck. And you could see his little heart had come out of his body. You could see his little heart beating. And Rinpoche there, he's pulling the hair. This is something you're going to do, I'll tell you. But pulling very vigorously the hair and doing all these prayers for that little duck. I thought, what a lucky duck. Imagine dying with Lama Zopa at your death, a little baby duck, you know, 20 minutes in the middle of the ring road. And then we finally got to the stupa and we started to do our prostrations at the bottom of the stupa and our hands are up here. 1 hour later, we're still saying dedication prayers for the baby duck, you know, our hands are getting very tired. That's very typical Lama Zopa if you know him. So we've got to remember, it's just, it's a real being there. Don't just look at a dead body and go get it out of the way. You've got to really, really realize there's a mind in that body. There's a mind in that little ant's body. There's a mind in that mouse's body. There's a mind in that human body. And you're right there. Do everything you can to help them, especially if it's your loved one, you've got the karma. So that 3 days is so precious, you know. All these practices you can do. Sponsor monasteries, all the practices are mentioned and then they're all in the back. So the classic one that monasteries do is recite the 8 prayers to benefit the dead. So there's 8 of them in the book. The King of Prayers, the dedication chapter from the Shanti Deva's Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, the prayer to be reborn in the blissful realm of Amitabha Buddha, the prayer for the beginning, middle and end of practice by Lama Tsongkhapa, until Buddhahood, another prayer, the daily prayer to Bodhisattva Maitreya taught by Buddha Shakyamuni, a prayer for the statue of Maitreya by the first Dalai Lama Gendun Drup, and a prayer for spontaneous bliss by the second Dalai Lama Gendun Gyatso. There's 8 classically, you know. Now, this is interesting too. I remember one time a friend of mine in San Francisco, a young woman, she worked for us for the prison project. She was not even 40, I think. And she had this car accident and then she died. Somehow she had incredibly intense life. She used to be a junkie. She'd be raped. She'd be attacked. She'd be beaten. She had intense karma to be harmed. And then she had this sort of fairly mild car accident. Her father took her to the hospital and she just didn't come back again. And so I guess all the students were around and the parents were devastated because they were keeping her breathing. And they finally had to decide that they'd pull the plug, you know, so that we got Geshe, I wasn't there, we got our Lama in San Francisco, Geshe Dagpa, to come and do the prayers. So he's driving there. And then before that, they kept her breathing. And then suddenly her lungs exploded. Her eyes burst open. And then, you know, she stopped breathing. And by the time Geshe got there, soon after, one of his assistants was there and I was texting him. And I said, has her mind left the body? And she said, Geshe-la says it would seem so. So that's a violent death. That's very unfortunate, you know. Her lungs exploded. It was shocking. Her eyes burst open. And it was a shocking death. So her mind left immediately, you know. So Geshe Dagpa did all the prayers for her. She was very good. She worked for the prison party. She was amazing. She took such care of the prison. She was incredible. So you do all these different prayers, so many different prayers, and they're all in the back of the book, and there's recommendations. There's dozens of them, you know, but it's up to you to decide one of them, two of them. Doesn't matter. It's up to you. They're all listed. For the essential, the same for these different scenarios, the same practices, but what you can do. The ideal of the 3 days is more leisurely, you know, that's the idea. So now, before you move the body, one of the things you can also do. Okay, when the time has come to move the body, that will be after 3 days, you can check. First, you must always check that the mind has left the body. So like I said, the best thing to do, you do the one of checking the heart chakra. And if it's no longer cold, you know, no longer warm, you know the mind has left. So then what you can do before you move the body, always make sure you can tap or pull the hair very vigorously at the crown chakra, like Lama Zerba did for the little baby duck, you know, helping the consciousness leave then. You can tap very vigorously there. And if the mind is still there, it can help it leave through there, and then it'll take a Pure Land rebirth. That's what they say. But you check first if the mind is gone. If the mind's gone, but you do this to check, to double check. So now the common thing, and Rinpoche mentions this, and it's in that book, for the Tibetans, and we would not normally do this, you consult a Tibetan astrologer. So typically a Tibetan would consult an astrologer immediately after the mind of their loved one has left the body. Astrology can indicate what practices should be done to prevent your loved one from being born in the lower realms and to help them to take a good rebirth. For instance, it can indicate which statue or tanka painting should be made on their behalf, or whether if you do this or that practice, they will have a good rebirth, or if be reborn as a monk or a nun or even a great lama. It can even predict whether good rebirth will be taken. However, it is said that this usually only works for ordinary people. Astrology cannot predict the future of either great holy beings or very evil people. You need to tell the astrologer which of the 12 animal signs your loved one was born under, as well as the date and time they passed away, even perhaps the hour, or whether it was in the morning, the afternoon, and so on. It's important to be accurate. There's astrology in the West, of course, but I'm not sure that predicts future lives and so forth. And now you can prepare your loved one's body. And that is in chapter 26, which we'll get to. Now, the next one, what to do if your loved one is in hospital. Well, the same practices. You do what you can. But here, you might only have 30 minutes. So there's the whole scenario is different, you know. So this is the point that seems to me, you know, you've got to have your wits about you. What tends to happen, we're so passive, we're so full of fear and drama and attachment. And then when your loved one dies, you have a panic attack and you hand it over to the doctors and the nurses. Well, they'll do their job, but you've got your job to do. So you should anticipate. And I've been told by people that nurses and doctors in the hospitals are very kind. So you should negotiate in advance. Your mummy's in hospital. For example, you know, maybe you're there some part of the day, and let's say you're not there at night and the nurses notice she's dead. Do not touch her, you tell them. Call me immediately. You give instructions. You know, they're happy to help. And then you do what you know, or let's say you're with your mummy in the hospital and she stops breathing at 2 a.m. Don't leap up and get the nurses. Nothing they can do. You then take as much time as you can. The longer, the better. 3, 4, 5 hours, the better. And even the hospital, you can ask them if there's a spare room, could you please have her put in the room? And they, if there is a spare room, they'll give it to you. You know, this is what happened with Lama Yeshe. This happened in Lama Yeshe. There's some talk in it in the book. I can't find it. But he, you know, he was in hospital in this Cedars Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. They were so kind. Read a bit later, we might come across it. And they let him, they gave him another room. They wheeled him very gently, and they kept him all day on the gurney, on the stretcher, and all his students and Lama Zopa around. And then they took him away, and they drove him then to Vajrapani Institute, drove very slowly up the coast, and took about 12, 14 hours to drive him up north to Vajrapani Institute. And then he was kept for 5 days at Vajrapani, and he was meditating the whole time. We'll talk about that later. But you know, you negotiate with the hospital. They're so happy to help, you know. So the other thing is this. So, okay, you stay with the body, even for, you know, you stay with the body, even for an hour. Ask the hospital to allow you as much time as possible with the body of your loved one, even an hour. When Lama Yeshe passed away, that's what I said, 5 o'clock, they let, blah, blah, blah. So you follow all the instructions in chapter 19, as soon as the breath stops, just the same instructions for everybody. And then, you know, if you have to leave and you can't have the place, one of the things you could do ask them to put him in the hospital morgue. You can't, there's nothing wrong with that. People tell me that hospitals have bodies in for months sometimes, or the memorial, the funeral homes, because, you know, people have to come from other countries or there's legal problems. There's no big deal. So you leave your loved one in the morgue, then you can go home for 3 days and do all the practices, and then you can get the body, you know. There's different things you can do. But you've got to really have the will to do this. You've got to really want to do it, not just sort of like pretend and just get rid of it all. You've got to really care about the mind in that person's body to help them. Every second you do prayers and practices can help them, you know. The same with your pussycat. So if you're dying at home, you need a pussycat. But people are revolted usually by this. Leave your pussycat there for 3 days, please, or until you notice the mind has left. So beneficial. You want your pussycat to get a human life, you know. We're so full of emotion and attachment to our animals. We think we're acting so nicely, but it's all just for our own sake half the time. We're not really thinking of the cat. That's how we go off and get them killed. You know, we're thinking we're so generous and compassionate. We're not. It's because it's inconvenient for us. You've got to think about this very carefully. Be quiet, whatever it is, as long as you can get, be quiet, same thing. And again, all the same practices in summary here. Do what you can in that period. All the same, listing the practices. Then before you have to move the body, if you have to move the body and not, if you're going to give the body over to the hospital, you do everything you can to help the consciousness leave. You do this one really vigorously, really strongly, you know. Again, you can do the astrology business if you want. But I think it's certainly this one says it. You definitely should do prayers and practices, you know. Have pujas and prayers done, very special. My God doesn't say so. What happened? Yeah, sponsor monasteries and Dharma centers. That you can certainly, if you have to give the body after an hour, really strongly get like Kopan Monastery. Immediately you email Kopan, you know, and you get them to do prayers and practices for your loved one right there. So helpful. So helpful. Or your friends, you know. Next scenario is if they've given their organs. This is so fascinating, this one. Before I edited this book, I just assumed naively that, you know, if you give your organs, they let you stay there for a while and then they take your organs when you're proper dead. But no, they don't. And Lama Zopa didn't realize this either. The Lamas didn't realize. I remember reading a book, a teaching that somebody at Karuna Hospice, the first guy who started it, this monk, in the 80s, and he interviewed a bunch of different lamas from the Kagyupas and the Nyingmapas, the Kalupas, the Sakyas, all of them, all about death and different ways to approach death and all this advice. And when it came to giving organs, every one of them praised it as a most special practice for the sake of the person, because they're dying with such compassion to want to give their organs to others. It's so special. And here too, Rinpoche praises hugely. But then when Rinpoche knew and heard about what happens, the lamas are quite shocked by this. So what happens in reality, as we all know, I didn't know before, they keep you breathing because as far as they're concerned, you're dead. You're dead, so then you keep you breathing. It's very fascinating. But there's now many problems with this. And this is the interesting point. I read this book. What time is it? Got 5 minutes to go. Time goes so quickly. Okay, I'll tell you the story when we finish. Yeah. Okay, so this book I read by an American medical journalist called Nick Terracey, and it's very funny. He's wonderfully funny. It's called The Undead. It's not about zombies. It's all the contradictions and problems and difficulties now in the American medical profession about exactly when death is. And one of the problems is this business of people coming back to life. It's most inconvenient. And there's no way in the world that the medical profession, you know, can factor this in. They're brain dead, mate. How come they come back to life? It's completely puzzling. But we all know from centuries all over the world, in every culture, there are reports of people supposedly, quote unquote, coming back to life. People in their coffins. I mean, Rinpoche talks in this book about one guy, a Nepali guy, who happens so regularly, he would die. He's on the funeral pyre and he wakes up again regularly. Well, I mean, even I've heard in Victorian times, they put a bell in the coffin so you can ring and very politely, excuse me, I'm still alive. Now, if this happens regularly, can you imagine the nightmare of the poor person who's in the coffin and they come back to life and they're buried. This will be the beyond trauma, and it's not an unusual thing. So this is now a big problem for the West, for all these people who think they're dead. What, have they got to change all their plans? They're cutting the liver out and they've got to put it back in, you know. Or they fought, and he was very cynical about it. He's a medical journalist. He was very cynical about the business, actually, this whole profession. When you've got the arrogant people, the elitist doctors, I mean, they're charging the biggest amounts of money, and it's a really competitive industry. This is not discounting Lama Zopa's approach for the person. Incredible compassion, incredible benefit. But they're so manipulative and political. Apparently, even in some European countries now, maybe in the UK, I don't know, the law now is that you will give your organs unless you ask otherwise. It used to be you got to give permission. This is so heavy. It's so political. It's so outrageous, actually. It's so wicked. Most people don't even know. So he was really quite cynical about many of the practices that happen now in this industry. I'm not discounting from anybody who's done it or wants to do it. And the benefit is unbelievable. Of course, for the person who's dying, the benefit is incredible. But the real problems now. So he had a whole chapter. For himself, he's an atheist, he said. And he's very funny. He cracks jokes about, because his profession is death. In the medical profession. So he got a whole chapter on people who have these so-called out-of-body experiences, which of course is just another one of the factors. He has no opinion about it, but he mentions it. You can't discount these experiences, you know? So there are people just who have ordinary operations, and then they describe what went on. And most of the doctors are just cynical, don't be ridiculous, not possible, blah, blah. But he joked and told one story of one woman who had to have such a radical procedure that they virtually had to make her dead in order to do the procedure. Meaning from their point of view, there was no way in the world she could be conscious. But she reported the most vivid of out-of-body experiences, and they just can't argue with it. So they're puzzled. So as one doctor is quoted in this book as saying, I can now say with certainty that consciousness is not a function of the brain. I don't know what it is, but this much I can say. So this is brilliant. People are being forced to look at their assumptions, you know, which is marvelous. But it's very scary because all their views are collapsing, you know, so people have to be very humble to accept this, you know. It's going to be very shocking. So as Lama Zopa says very politely, the hospitals need to be very careful. And this is the point. One story I found very fascinating. He reported one woman who's giving her organs, and of course they keep you breathing. And of course you look all warm and toasty. You look alive. And the fact is you are alive. That's the point. You can't live on your own. Your gross consciousness has ceased, but your subtle mind is there. And this is why it's so crystal clear, as Rinpoche says. Okay, I'll read Rinpoche. Some people decide, what's going on with my glasses? Can't see well. Some people decide to offer their organs to others after they've died. Does this disturb the mind? It seems that when the person is considered brain dead, the doctors keep the body breathing artificially, and they continue to keep the body breathing when they actually cut out the organs. I question this. The brain may no longer be functioning, but if the person has the karma to breathe, even if artificially, this means they have the karma to be alive. It means that the mind has, the presence of the mind, even subtle, is why the body is still warm, because all the mind is what causes it to be a human, because we don't factor that in Buddhism in the West. We only factor the brain in. Also, as we discuss in chapter 7, even when the breath has stopped and someone has been declared brain dead, people have been known to come back to life. This means that the usual definition of death is wrong. This is a big question that needs to be discussed with learned great meditators. The hospital needs to be careful. I asked him to say more. He said, that's enough. The hospital needs to be careful. However, if the person is brain dead, which means the gross consciousness has ceased, they may not feel anything when the organs are cut out. That makes sense. You know, like you're under anesthetic, you don't feel it. But if the person is not in meditation when this happens, then I think it may not matter. Now, this is the point here. This, I told him to have this experience, right? I told this what I read in this book. This woman who was giving her organs, there she was, brain dead. She was kept alive, all warm and toasty, which means her subtle mind was there. Excuse me. And the subtle mind is what can have these out-of-body experiences in a coma, in a sleep, you know, etc. And you're going to see now, including this. the nurse who was monitoring the heartbeat while she was on the operating table, and she said as they got the circular saw to cut her from head to toe to open her up to take her organs, she observed that the heart went from 100 to 200 beats a minute. So as the author said, I wonder what a dead body has to be worried about. So this is my analysis based upon this Buddhist view. The subtle mind is there. So she was having what they call an out-of-body experience. You would have exactly while in the room of your dead loved one, that's why you would stay quiet. Because the subtle, even though the mind, the gross mind has ceased, but the subtle mind of your grandmother is there. And she can be having a very powerful experience of seeing you and hearing everything that's going on. And there you are talking and gossiping and having drinks of wine and talking about her will. How distressing can you imagine for your grandma's mind? Because they still know who they are. This is so powerful. This is why coma, dreams, we don't think that in the West. We think, oh, she's asleep. She won't know. Not true. So this woman, we can deduce, was having an out-of-body experience, meaning she was observing what they were doing. She knows she's still who she is, and she's having a complete panic attack. What have they done? They realize I'm not dead yet, and they're going to cut me open. Of course her heart would go to 200 beats a minute. This could be very disturbing, and that could completely change the karmic seed and freak out. And then when she does die, probably on the table, she might, more than likely, the mind will leave the body during that experience. It could be a negative karmic seed, and they've sent her to the lower realms. So that's what Mishay says, the hospital better be careful. So this is the one big issue. Now, 99% of people, like in operations, don't have out-of-body experience. So you could argue that 99% of people who die won't be affected. As Mishay says, they won't feel anything. And if their subtle mind isn't observing, they won't know. So it will be okay. And even later on, I'm asked from Mishay, is it possible that even after the cutting the organs out, the mind can still be there? He said, yes, it could be, it's possible. So for many people, it won't be disturbing, but for the few that it could be, it's very distressing. So it's something to think about. It's something to think about. And let's discuss them in questions, you know. But nevertheless, Rinpoche says, because your loved one as an organ donor died with thought of benefiting others, I think that they won't be disturbed when the body is cut and therefore won't be reborn in the lower realms. That's assuming they don't have this subtle consciousness of experience, you know. The subtle consciousness is still there, but because earlier with their gross mind, they dedicated their body, they made the charity of their body, which is a virtue they acquired merit. Making charity of their body before they passed away, dedicating to others is the same as if they were alive and made charity of their body. It's as if they had chosen to offer their life or their limbs to others. Many great masters actually did this. Of course, I can't say 100% that there's no worldly concern for everyone who offers their organs, but generally speaking, I think you can say that because there are no expectations, no worldly mind involved, they are really making charity. As there is no concern about reputation, no thought of power, no thought of getting something, this would be a sincere giving, which means the mind is virtuous. Still, it's good to make sure that the practice of jhanwa is done for your loved one. We'll get to that after the cremation or burial. So the other thing is, what was I about to say? I forget. Something else, I can't remember. Oh, yes, another lama. I mean, I couldn't put it in here because it's not his book. Another lama, the Lama Geshe Lodin in France. I think he's a yogi. He's at the Institute Vajrayogini. When I was there, when I was working on this book, and I asked him many questions as well, I couldn't put his answers in here because this is Lama Zopa's book. But he said he thought, no, it doesn't necessarily follow that everybody who's giving their organs will have a peaceful death. Because let's say, and it's my example now, let's say when you're 20 years old, you decide to give your organs and you've forgotten all about it. And here you are 40 and you're a raging alcoholic and a maniac. I don't think that thought of giving your organs 20 years ago will bring much help. So the assumption here with Rinpoche is it's all very kind of in the mind of the person at the time they're dying. You know, it's kind of current. That makes sense. But he says, you know, where does he say this? So when the time has come to receive the body from the hospital, okay, just check that the mind has left the body. You can still do that. So just because the organs have been cut out doesn't mean the subtle mind has left the body. Rinpoche said that. However, I can't say yes and I can't say no. It depends on the individual. For some people, depending on which organs have been taken, the subtle conscious could still be there. So it's good to check if the consciousness is still there. So you do all the business the same as before. Okay, that's enough for today. We'll have questions tomorrow, you people, okay? So now tomorrow is going to be a bit different day because I can't do the second session. I had something else booked already. So I think we'll do... Steph, where are you, Steph? Where's Steph?
Steph's not here. She's had to go to a meeting, Venerable.
Oh, okay, so Steph can... Okay, well, I'll email Steph and make some suggestions for a meditation. Or you can have a shorter session. You know, it doesn't need to be an hour and a half. Just have a shorter session tomorrow, the second session, just a shorter one. And I've got a feeling maybe it's good if Steph just reads the meditation very slowly going through the eight stages. What do you think? That might be good, isn't it? She just read Rinpoche's words and go very slowly through it. And you just think about it and try and hear it and try and visualize imagining it's happening. I think it's a very good meditation. She just reads Dhammasopa's words. It's pretty straightforward. And just try and go through it very slowly. Maybe it takes about 20 to 25 minutes. That's enough, I'd say. Just a short session tomorrow afternoon. I'm sorry, I have to shortchange you. Okay, you people?
Would you like the prayer screen shared?
No, don't do. I think just have the thoughts. Thank you, Faye. I like to just do the thoughts. Have the thoughts. No, yeah, put them up there. We'll do the thoughts and then we'll do the prayer in Tibetan. It's nice to do that. Thank you, darling. So we think. I'll say them in my words. So, you know, because of this virtuous karma, meaning these 3 hours we've been together, as many moments as there have been, is as many seeds we've planted. How marvelous. We've done a rich 3 hours of gardening. We're thinking, due to all these virtuous karmic seeds that we've planted, because of this, may we quickly become a Buddha. May these seeds ripen. May we nourish these seeds from this moment forward so we do manifest as a Buddha. Why? So we can lead all suffering sentient beings without exception to that very state. And the second little prayer, may this amazing, marvelous, unbelievable, outrageous paradigm shift in the mind from cherishing self to only cherishing others and only wanting to benefit others until now into enlightenment. That's called bodhicitta. May it, where it hasn't arisen in minds, may it arise. And where it has arisen, may we nourish it and may it grow and grow and not diminish. So we'll go back again and say the Tibetans, Ray, Faye, sweetheart, the Perth prayer in Tibetan. That's it. Gewa di nyu du dai lama sangge dro gyune dro wa chi kyang ma lu pa jai sala Kupa Shok Jang Chod Sem Chog Rinpoche Ma Khe Panam Khe Gyo Chig Khe Panyam Pa Me Payang Gong Ne Gong Du Pelba Shok. Thank you, sweetheart. Very kind. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Venerable Rubino.
Bye, darlings.
Thank you, Venerable Rubino.